Hi, again, it's me again, Glenn Rowe, professor at the Sorbonne of Digital Humanities, but also newly a member of the LabX Obville, which we just want to talk about today. Two of the projects that we've seen yesterday, that the use and reuse, and then this morning, the empirical literary history, sort of originated out of the LabX. And in fact, I'm between the two sort of pillars of the LabX itself, the director Didier Alexandre and the associate director Jean-Gabriel Ganassia. And so as a structure, I think if you're not familiar, why should you be? There's this sort of initiative of excellence in France, out of which came this idea of forming these laboratories of excellence, which was a way of investing in the future. And so with the long-term investment by the French government to assemble multidisciplinary, pluridisciplinary teams around certain thematic subjects and to fund them either for 10 years or 8 years. And I think the LabX Obville, which is the laboratoire de l'observatoire de la vie littéraire. So it's the Observatory of Literary Life. We'll talk a bit about this. focus of the LabX on a more literary digital humanities. But in a way, it was formed before this great fusion that happened this year. So Sorbonne Université is the newest university in the world, maybe in France at least. It's begun. You may have heard of the Sorbonne before and think that's odd, but nonetheless, this instantiation of Sorbonne University began this year. in January, which was a fusion of two previous universities, Université Pierre et Marie Curie, Paris 6, and Paris 4, which was the Université Paris-Sorbonne. So bringing the Faculty of Letters, which was the Université of Paris-Sorbonne, together with the Faculty of Sciences, there was also a Faculty of Medicine, this is a new university. And in fact, the LabX reflected already this sort of structuring notion of bringing, in our case, computer science together with literary studies. And so you can just see here on the left we have, and it's well situated, Paris 6, which is now the Faculty of Sciences, and the Faculty of Letters on the right. And these are also bolstered by partnerships both with the CNRS, so it becomes part of the CNRS, which at Paris 6, or at the Faculty of Sciences, is a... Now, you two can intervene anytime I make a mistake or say something wrong. With Jean-Gabriel Delab at Lipsis, which is the informatique, which is a computer science lab, and CELF, which is the center of French language and literature research. So CNRS centers, so this is a sort of horizontal of this partnership, and then also a full partnership with the Bibliothèque Nationale. So this is an important sort of notion of this, is that we have computer science, we have literary scholars, and then we have the BNF there sort of bolstering this. And so the idea here, the objectives of Obville in general, and this started in 2012 and it will finish up at the end of 2019, was a sort of notion of, based on projects and how projects come to the LabX, and they would come and propose different projects, you would establish a sort of edition, so digital scholarly editions, digitization component, which would then be followed by text mining, search and retrieval, a visualization idea, so how then you can use these data in different ways, incorporate ontologies, and then finally feed that into a sort of loop of research pedagogy for young postdocs and doctoral students. And this coalesced around, this was more or less a self-selecting group, so people would come to the LabX, they'd propose these different projects, and not all of these projects did all of the things in equal measures, if you will. So some were more concerned at the top. These are more theoretical questions based on literature over the longue durée. you have critical corpora that were established, so the Corpus Critique, which was one of Alexandre Geffin's corpus we saw this morning. Projects around certain thematics, like L'Art du Théâtre, is about the discourse around theater. So the discourse around the admonition around the spectator arts. École is a great project that takes a sort of we would say syllabus in the American way. So takes sort of these sort of paratextual documents that come out of the training in the late 19th century. So what were they reading? What was on the syllabus? What were they learning on in school? What was on the exams? To sort of examine the sort of scope of literature at that time. And we've seen the très grand base de données yesterday with use and reuse. There's also archival projects that aim to sort of do new things in this space around authors. So Molière, for example, you have all of Molière, but you also have every sort of work of criticism about Molière for 200 years. And so it's a way of expanding the sort of notion of this. And Apollinaire is another interesting project that I'll talk about in a little bit. And then you have sort of corpora that are formed around different generic things like fable. So looking at a very long-term literary history of the fable from ancient times through La Fontaine and then further. And the Facétie, which is just a type of text in the late Renaissance, early 16th, 17th century. Voilà. Along with this comes the development of tools to sort of speak to this notion that you'll have a digitization, but then you also have an exploration, you also have a sort of edition component. So these are tools that were developed in the LabX and then are now available or developed in tandem with the LabX, such as Philologic 4, and that are now available online, more or less open source. Then it goes to sort of a range of publishing technologies, lexicometric, taxonometry, as we call it, intertextuality tools, Médide, Phébus, and then semantic analysis tools. So we'll go into a bit of this. So more or less, most of these projects constituted a corpus. What was their corpus? There was a digitization moment. There was an editing moment. Everything was put into TEI-XML. And then, as just the very first thing, we publish these. You put these online, and people can sort of use the XML tags to just sort of navigate these texts. All these texts will be available, I believe, all of the Avir corpora via the BNF as EPUBs. Right? So you can get them as EPUBs, you can get them as the XML, all open source and on. But there was also moments such as the Apollinaire project where we wanted to think more or less about, well, what is a digital edition? Well, what can you include in it that you can't include in a print edition? And so for Apollinaire, they've included sound files, video files, all of the sort of different states of the text, and put it in a platform that's sort of developed in tandem with Harvard, right, with the Media Lab in Harvard, where you can sort of just see this visualization of all these documents around Apollinaire. You choose one, and then it shows you the relationships between this, so you can get modern people reading Apollinaire poems on YouTube, for example, through this new edition. And there's a sense of again taking leveraging the tags from TEI, which for all of you seems a bit banal, but for students it's very important. It's a great moment of sort of training to get them to think about text and to think about what scholarly editions are, what you can do with these tags later on, and then putting these also into other platforms which use this, which we've seen Philologic a few times here. Here's another instance of the corpus critique under Philologic with its bells and whistles that we've all seen by now. And then there's sort of standalone tools that were developed. This is called Colette, and it's developed by Frédéric Glorieux. And it's a great tool because you can take two terms, in this case, femme et fille, and see the sort of semantic relationships around it, the linkings around these two terms, and then, perhaps more importantly, the sort of shared terms in the middle. So again, just ways of taking these corpora, developing interesting new ways of thinking about them, of leveraging the digitization moment, and then making these tools available to the wider public. This is a scenographic graph that shows it's specific to theater. This is work out of Marc Duguay's thesis. And basically what this shows is a graph of entrances and exits in the scenic sort of field of one play. So you have the play in four acts, which is the sort of horizontal, and the vertical are the people that are on stage at any given time. So it allows you to sort of step back and look in an abstract way about scenic presence, and then you can compare these graphs to other graphs. And so there was an interesting moment where, Claudel, who didn't profess any great liking for Corneille, it ended up the scenic representation of Claudel's plays was quite similar, in abstract terms, to the rhythm and the pacing and the scenic occupation of Corneille, which is something that we wouldn't necessarily associate. Another work on theater. Here we have the drama graph is the tool is called, and it sort of plots again the same sort of information, who's with whom at any given time, with a certain directionality of the these are the people that talk to it. This is about speaking, right? This is the speaking sense. So this is of course not dissimilar in form or in function from Franco Moretti's work on network theory, plot and analysis. And so we've just sort of operationalize that, to use another Meridian favorite, into this tool, which is interesting. And again, when you do these sorts of abstractions, what's interesting, especially with someone like Claudel, who changes his plays over time, you can compare one play to another, and you can see where perhaps, for whatever reason, later in time, a character becomes less important, or speaks less, or in effectively the same scenic space. Also, there's also tools for what we call here in France genetic criticism, and this is Médite, developed by Jean-Gabriel Ganassia, which allows you to see, which is a text comparison tool, but a bit different than the sequence aligners that we've been talking about now. This looks for differences rather than similarities, right? So this is sort of a classic tool, but in this case, it's a sort of intelligent comparison, because it tells you where it thinks the deletions are, where it thinks the insertions are. So here you can see in the red from the left, again, this is a Claudel play, what's taken out and what comes back in. So you can begin to sort of construct an idea of how plays develop, of how the writing of theater develops within an author's, within that corpus over time. Here we have a large deletion from one version of the
L'annonce faite à Marie.
Right. So a large deletion and then putting it. So it's a way of sort of using these tools to enter into the notion of how artists craft their work. And again, we've seen yesterday TextAlign, which is another tool developed within this framework, and specifically within this Mellon project. So the overall strategy of Avile is to sort of have this kernel of activity, which then reaches out within this strategy of excellence, within this idea in the French sphere. And so we're also meant to talk a bit about Obville and the context of French digital humanities, which is an exciting topic, but it's also a huge topic, as digital humanities is anywhere. But in France, it's particularly interesting because I think at least from an outside now, an inside observer, over the past 8 years, or the existence of Obville, Les Humanités Numériques, Digital Humanities in France, has sort of finally arrived, if you will. It's become an official thing. It's Humanité Digitale if you cross over into Switzerland, but that's a different matter. And so I think it's important to think about, I think Obville's had a role in that, but it doesn't mean that Obville's the only sort of LabX or even LabX working on these tools. And if we were to talk a bit about digital humanities in France, as with everywhere, it gets a bit too diffuse. It's a huge subject, looking at 3D visualization, archaeology. It spans a lot of fields. And so if we perhaps put the question in better focus, if we change a bit of the scale and move from this continent of common culture, which is digital humanities, to a specific country, we can perhaps have a better understanding of where Obville fits in this context. And I think the specificity of Obville, which you've seen, which brings together, again, teachers, researchers, students, in this idea of research, teaching, formation, and engineers, and development within this realm, is that they borrow, again, to go back to the structure, which is physically performed here, between computer science, and it's a productive conversation between computer science and between literary studies. And so we take at Obville, the sort of basic kernel of common understanding is the literary text, right? If I can use that in as much expansive way as I can. So text could be almost anything, but there's this notion that the literary text is in fact what we're interested in, and its elaboration through the two disciplinary fields of computer science and literary studies. So obviously, this brings up questions of data and how we train younger scholars to work with data, and the data we feel can't just be raw data that you grab. It has to be enriched. It should probably be transcribed and formatted in TEI. edited it according to longstanding philological principles. So there's a sense of continuing a philological tradition that at the Sorbonne is very important. But there's also this notion of how we can expand that with these new tools into different realms. And so this specificity then of the literary text and its elaboration in digital humanities is important for Obville because of this, again, this notion of training, what we call in France formation. So how we can train doctorants and postdoctorants in this field, which is multidisciplinary, but in a way that can be, I wouldn't say dangerous, but it can be. In a realm such as it can be hard to be between two disciplines, career-wise. I think this is a problem not only in France. It's a particular problem in France, but it's a problem the world over. And so, how do we sort of get people from one discipline to the other, between the disciplines, without they're losing that sort of scope? And I think this is the problem in computer science, where some students may be discouraged from working on digital humanities things, and it's the same in literary studies, where we might do that. And so we see, in the best of all possible worlds, Obville as a sort of incubator based on these practices in production. So this is a way of sort of how can we institutionally support younger scholars in exploring these issues and this development things, but while keeping them either on one side of the Rue des Écoles or the other. So in this same spirit, we've established a bilicence, so it's a double degree in the bachelor program, in the undergraduate program, Informatique and Lettres, so it's computer science. And this is a proper double degree. They have to do. They have to be very motivated. It's a double cursus. They have to do a full computer science degree and a full literary studies degree. And it allows them again to think about that space in between the two, which I think is me represented here physically, but also digital humanities in general. So it allows students to explore that space, but then also keep their options open on either side of that disciplinary divide. And so if we think then also about how we can enable these young researchers, give them a solid digital training, we've also incorporated master's modules in publishing and multimedia, audiovisual communications. So within that realm, there's modules on digital training within the Faculty of Letters. There's now been a few PhDs that have been defended under the umbrella of Obville, some very good ones, Marine Riguet, Marc Louguet. So these things are sort of, and there's been, I'd say, a fairly good success of these young scholars that have gone on to become maîtres de conf. I think six or five maîtres de conf around the planet, and then have also become research engineers. Most recently at Paris 3. So this question, I think we could think about this. This is a question, again, that's not specific to France, but yet it is also keenly felt here, about how we should think about formations or the teaching of digital humanities. And so this is a book published in-house, if you will, by Aurélien Berra and Florence Claveau, which sort of gives a sort of map of digital humanities teaching around France. And it's interesting in and of itself as a sort of intellectual historical object, but what it does is raise important questions that I think we can all think about and resonates wherever we come from. And this would be: do we need a specific courses in digital humanities? Is it a discipline? I mean, that's an old debate that's been going on since forever. But if it is a discipline, then you need courses that reflect that disciplinarity. If it's not a discipline, do you need a course at all? How do you have a course that's not? I mean, these are questions I think that are interesting. How do we instill? Is it just enough to have someone learn to code? That's another question. Learn to code and it'll just happen, or you get some training. I think it's more. There's something in the middle there that we need to sort of construct and think about productively. And how we can move those on. And then more importantly, perhaps after that, is in these early stages of academic careers, and in France there's always a few different ways you could go. You could go into the enseignant-chercheur realm, you could also become an ingénieur de recherche. Those are probably equally weighted as statuses in the academic. So, you know, so depending on the choices you make, at some point you could end up in one of those affiliations. And then how do you valorize then digital humanities work within those structures? How do you get reward for promotion and rewarded for these different things in structures that are so deeply disciplinary and so deeply ingrained in a lot? So I think these are things we're thinking about. We're not the only ones that are thinking about it, and I think there are some other projects in France that are doing great things. For example, we have in Tours, there is this great sort of ressource numérique pour l'édition des archives de la Renaissance, which is a great project. Has a lot in common with Hauteville because it's based in a new mer. It's based in a CNRS. This case, it's the UMR 7323. Voilà. It doesn't need to mean anything to you. We all know the numbers intrinsically. But it's great because it brings together historians, musicologists, which we have one here today, art historians, literary experts, relies on this big computer laboratory in Tours. So there's a sense of high-performance computing going on with this large scope of humanistic activity. And its main purpose really is the production of enriched data. So again, this idea that we can involve students, we can involve early career graduates in producing data. This is one thing that Obvio has been particularly good at, producing enriched data that can then be reused and published in training. And then also at the University of Grenoble is this great project on les manuscrits de Stendhal. This is Thomas Le Barbet who's there. And this is a project that is part of, in Grenoble at least, what's called a data institute. So it's this notion that even though it's a humanities project, even though it's small data, even though there's all these things, it can participate in these larger sort of structures of thinking about data and data. You know, we're at this moment where data analytics is sort of the order of the day and sort of winning in everywhere. So having humanities projects structured within or conceived of within these structures, I think, is very important. There's also here now at Sorbonne another sort of one of such of these data institutes, which would be the Institut des Sciences du Calcul des Données. And now we're currently thinking about establishing a team of digital humanities, General Gabriel will be there, of course, within this institute, and then what that means. So what that means to have digital humanities within an institute in the Faculty of Sciences, within this data analytic realm, and then how can we ensure that the dialogue continues between, that it doesn't just become data among other data, that somehow the specificity of the digital humanities data and the specificity of the humanities projects that come out of it are still sort of taken into account within these larger structures. And so that's sort of where we're thinking about the future for Obvio. And I'd just say in the French space also things are moving along. Humanistica is the Francophone Association of Digital Humanities. And it's the first, it's now an official member of ADHO, which ADHO is the digital humanities umbrella organization. So it's not an official voting member. And it's also the only member that's not nationalist, sort of nationally. It's based around just Francophone expression. So it's really interesting. There's a good poll in Quebec, as you can imagine, Lausanne and French-speaking Switzerland, also obviously in France, and it's going to move out into these different realms. And so there, I think we're moving in this area. I think the French government seems fairly interested in supporting research going forward. There's this Humanum, which is the très grande infrastructure, so it's everything's très grand. This is the very great, you can't be, just a middle, yeah. Excellent, the très grande excellent infrastructure, but it's for digital humanities, and I think it's well supported, it's part of the CNRS, and it's meant to sort of, as we've seen today, there's all these great development going on. If you can sort of bring projects together to develop things in an open source way, in a collaborative way, these tools can be reused. People can learn so much just from engaging with other people's data. So it's a repository for data. It's a way of thinking through tools. And And that's sort of, I think, where also Obville will end up when we rethink about it. In the future, is a platform or a space or some sort of infrastructure that will make the corpora available, allow people to query it using different tools developed in-house or elsewhere, and then export these data back to their place. So I think that's all I have to say. Would you two like to interject anything? Oui? C'est bon?
C'est bon. Ça va? Just concerning education, so I think maybe to make it understandable, the French system is very rigid in a way, and it's very difficult, for instance, for a scientific student to study, to have a module in literature, or for a student in literature to study science. And what we want to do is, this is an open question, as you mentioned before, do we need to have some interdisciplinary syllabus or I don't know how you call them. And we had the same problem a few years ago when I was in charge of cognitive science, and the question was, do we need to have some master in cognitive science, or is it better to have people specialized in neuroscience who get some course in computer science or something like this? And we have exactly the same problem. So one of the solutions we tried to implement was, as you mentioned, the double licence. I don't know how to translate it, which I think is very, very interesting. But okay, we have experience of a very bright student because we it's very selective, and so one of the problems that they need to have an international internship on the third year. So if some of you want to maybe to have this kind of student, I think it could be very, very, very useful. So these are very good students. So if you are able to have this student, I think it would be. But it's not so easy. I think it's really complex requirement. Yeah, yes, they have to do digital humanities. So maybe we could try to see if it is possible to soften this requirement and maybe to have either literature or a computer science courses. But if you, because you're an international science, I think it could be very interesting for this student and maybe for you, because these are good students. And one disappointment in a way is that when I discussed with this student, the problem is that, okay, they were very excited and very happy to study both computer science and literature, but most of them, if there is no real digital humanities master, they want now to study either computer science or maybe cognitive science or something like this, but not really literature. And so I hope it will change in the future. But okay, from a personal perspective, we're happy because these students have are well educated, and they obtain good job, and they will. But maybe this is an open question. So, and this is a real problem. You agree with this, I think.
And we also thought about a minor. In an undergraduate program, which doesn't take much, you don't have to change much, you just sort of rearrange classes that already exist in certain ways. And basically the idea here is that, which is a sort of block on from the American way, that you have a disciplinary major, whether it be in computer science, or it could be in any discipline, doesn't really matter. And then you have a digital humanities minor on which that feeds in the sort of more methodological things into this major. So that's another way of thinking about it. But I don't know, I think we can, if you have any questions or comments or anything.
So it's time now for a general discussion. So if you have comment on this or on the previous talk, so it's time to, maybe we had a discussion on the notion of model, for instance, if you want to resume this discussion, or about this electronic edition of the Mishnah. You say electronic edition, yeah. Electronic, no. Digital edition, sorry. No, maybe. Oh, yeah.
Hi, thank you. It's a really interesting program and set of goals and an amazing amount of progress that you guys have. And I wanted to ask a question about the way the disciplinary work breaks down here in France, sort of with the United States system as a comparandum. Basically, what I'm going to ask about is computational linguistics and how often it comes up. The reason being that, well, let me just ask you that. Does computational linguistics as a department figure in your work, or is it?
Yes. No. There are, but maybe you know, we have some department of automatic language processing. But there are also department of computational linguistics. So they have different name. I don't remember. In the case of Sorbonne, there is a department on natural language processing, and in other place also. I think in Diderot, René Diderot, you had a lot of computational linguistic tools. But the history of computational linguistics is a little bit different in France and in Europe, because you remember the origin of computational linguistics was the fact that in 1966, I think after the ALPAC report, I think almost all the lab which were working on automatic translation closed, and they open labs on computational linguistics. So there were some labs working on automatic translation in France, yeah. But you have also some linguists. So it's and you have other labs in Nanterre, for instance, and so we have there are a lot of and yes, in Caen, you have a lot of labs. And there are people working on digital humanities in connection with this lab. So it's... Okay.
So the... Okay.
In Sorbonne, the studies for French language are separated from French literature. We have an UFR de littérature française and an UFR de langue française. And in the UFR of langue française, there are linguistic studies and also linguistic computationals.
Okay.
This is separated, and it's not easy to work together.
And is that something that you guys look to when looking for methodological examples, sort of templates?
From my mind, I mean, I know that the person that runs there is a Informatique et Langue, I think. Mm-hmm. There's a program, Computer Science and Language, so mm-hmm. which is... So in my mind, this is where a minor or something would be really interesting, because you can draw from those. As Didier just mentioned, it's actually kind of rigid. It's hard. It seems natural that someone working on French language would also be interested in French literature or vice versa. And it may be true, but it's actually hard institutionally for them. There's separate courses, and they have. But a minor sort of gets you around that, because it becomes transversal, right? So then you can, there's a course in automatic language, there's a course in corpus linguistics and things mm-hmm. like that, where you could say, I think you should take that. And so that's a way of trying to get around this sort of more rigid disciplinary.
So I think the landscape is very variegated and very rich. The oldest master in digital humanities is at the École Nationale de Chartres and has been existing for, I believe, 12 years or something like that, very successfully. It's very competitive. I mean, it's competitive. It's actually, you have to pay tuition fee compared to other public masters, an exceptional thing in France. They have formed, like, I think, 20 people every year for 12 years now, and there I think it's hard to find a project in digital humanities in France without an engineer which has been educated there.
Right.
I mean, since they started so early, they are really widespread. There is a second master which we have funded with them and the UHSS and the École Normale Supérieure in Digital Humanities, which is not a double degree but an intermediate. So people have to take some programming classes and some regular classes. It's very open, so you can do Chinese archaeology and digital humanities, or you can do cuneiform and digital humanities, or you can do French art history and digital humanities. There is also a master in digital humanities at Paris 8, and there's also one in Paris 1. There is also one in Paris 10. There is also one in Toulouse, if I'm not mistaken. So there's a lot. And then you have masters in NLP, so Traitement Automatique Langage. There's a big one at the INALCO. There's a big one at Paris 3. So most big schools, and there are French universities tend to be big, would you offer something like that?
But it sounds basically like digital humanities programs are usually blends of a humanistic discipline and an engineering discipline, like computer science, and then you have separately natural language processing departments, which are essentially a branch of computational linguistics. That's kind of the impression.
So in our master is called Digital and Computational Humanities, and we teach also computer vision, and we teach also NLP to humanists.
Okay.
So then there's another master for people that are coming more from the sciences. So there's all the there's different programs in France working on sciences de données, data scientists, big projects.
Right.
And that's another addition. In addition to NLP, in addition to digital humanities, those are people coming more from a scientific background and plunging into data.
Well, so yeah, in the United States, if I could just explain the motivation for the question, and then I'll stop taking up the panel's time. But essentially, data science in the United States has a tendency to really focus on how to interrogate a large data set to basically say, like, this is what the patterns in the data actually show in a meaningful way, as opposed to just wonking around until you end up with a pattern, which you always will. So it doesn't necessarily teach you much about human behavior, whereas in computer science in the United States, the focus is pretty strongly in my understanding in the programs that I've visited and participated in. The focus is on engineering. So you're trying to produce an application, which is great for digital humanities dissemination, like when you want to publish a library of texts or you want to publish your visualization tool, you need those guys and you need those skills. But when it comes to taking a large body of literature and trying to ask humanistic questions, the closest that I've found for a sound methodology comes from computational linguistics, not from the branch of natural language processing specifically, but other branches of computational linguistics that are specifically designed to try and ask questions about human cognition or human behavior, with the only data set being actual produced language. It's not that the way they do things just works out of the box. It's just that when you're setting out to sort of craft a new discipline, you guys were talking about, and Glenn especially, you were talking about, like, well, how do you, like, set up a set of standard practices that creates a discipline? And I was basically just suggesting that certain aspects of computational linguistics, as we understand, are divisions disciplinarily. And we have the same issues with, like, there's the discipline divisions, and then there's the buildings on campus, and those lines don't match properly. But yeah, so I was basically suggesting that it's been productive to investigate those methods and asking how much connection you guys already have with them. That was the motivation.
I feel very strongly about this issue because we're talking about language, right? Language is the medium of literature. And although I kind of agree with you that contemporary computational linguistic models are becoming interesting and significant, but the focus is widely on language as such, not aesthetically motivated language. So there's this huge disconnect which exists anyway, where you get a critical address to literature is done by critics, and then there are the practitioners who actually make it, and they make it in cultural contexts that are historical. And now there are some practitioners who make linguistic artifacts that are computationally implicated. But there isn't a huge corpus of that, but all of the corpora are either focused on the past or on some sort of speculative future. And that speculative future is in the control of engineers and commercially motivated, even better funded engineers than the ones in the universities. So this address to a sort of language in the context of the humanities after the computation is something that I don't think it can be done without a sort of ideological political commitment to humanistic values that are not being represented even by sophisticated contemporary computational linguistic models, let alone, data mining.
I would agree, and I think that's why, at least in the context of Obvio, the starting point was there will be some digital exploration, but the starting point is literature. I mean, that's the point. And if it's about language, also it's about language as a literary expression, and how we can use tools, often or algorithms often developed for other tools. That's part of it. But also, how can we develop our own within that context with engineers that aren't working for Google to explore these corpora, which are small in comparison to big things. Some are really big, and you need other tools. But I think the idea is always coming from the human. It has to always, from our standpoint, even from Jean-Gabriel's, I think we start from the humanistic. We start from that, and then what we can do with the computer science side of it, hopefully that's an exploration. The hard part is, I think, you might disagree, but it's difficult then to get buy-in from computer scientists sometimes within that framework, because they think you're not starting on even footing. You're starting from this specificity of literature that's somehow more than other texts, or somehow different.
We
right?
have a way ahead of them. That's my point. They think that they are ahead of us, but they are not. We are way ahead of them.
I just to reinforce your point, over time, this is about 30 years that Artful has existed, and all our best engineers have degrees in literature first, and then
or linguistics. Linguistics.
Excuse me?
Or linguistics.
Do we have
Russ came out of French linguistics?
We had Russ came out of linguistics, but most of them come out of a strong literary training.
Well, this is a follow up on this late last points of the discussion. It seems to me that one of the elements in the current digital humanities obsession with tools and methodologies is the idea that because you can impoverish language by making it computational, you will get new knowledge from that. It's not clear that we've done that yet now, and I think most presentations of digital humanities tend to be focused on the tools, because we have to solve that kind of problem now, how to make language computational, and we do that by impoverishing language. And that impoverishment has also to be questioned now, because we are overall establishing new methods of knowledge validation and knowledge production. And so my question would be, this is the French digital humanity, it's presented as a French digital humanities, and we carry this discussion as if there is a consensus about what digital humanities is. And so French, I would like to hear you to talk more about epistemological differences and theoretical differences in the approaches to the computational, the datafication of language, let's put it that
yeah, yeah.
way.
No. I mean, it's a huge subject. And I think the point is that French or otherwise, digital humanities, you just can't pin it down, because somebody is just going to come along and say, well, that's not my DHHU, you know, or vice versa. So it's not really but an argument worth having. But from the French perspective, from our perspective at least, from my perspective, in general, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that even metaphors we use, text mining, for example, data mining, for them, I mean, the whole metaphor is about stripping out from the earth and finding just the little good bits and throwing the rest away, right? I mean, that's a terrible metaphor for thinking about using corpora, right? We should want to enrich things, right? We should, and that's what we've started with Obvil, is to think about, well, how are these texts, and what can we add to them? What more can we put in them that we can then think about this enriched data as ways of building things rather than strip mining things out? Because I think there is a deformation that happens in lots of algorithmic approaches that can yield interesting results and can definitely be heuristic tools to move into, but perhaps we don't think seriously enough about what's being excluded as opposed to what's being counted. Maybe that's fine.
Yeah, I think one of the problems is, yes, behind the tool you have implicit theory, and it's very difficult to make them explicit and then to understand that the use of model is very important, because the model is an intermediate between you and the thing you are studying. And so there are some implicit theory behind the model which need to be explicited. And I think, yes, this need to be maybe to get some more fundamental reflection on the epistemology of digital humanities, but it's a very broad question. But now, yes, with our students, the problem we have is that sometimes you have some people who are educated in literature, so they have a very good understanding of the the text, but they don't know. So they use the tools, but without knowing exactly what are the limits of the tool, and maybe in a way which is a little bit biased and confused. And on the other end, my computer science students, it's very difficult to make them interested really in the text themselves. And so they are very happy with the tools which work. They are very bright, but it's very difficult. So I don't know how long does it take to train students to be able to do this. There are some people, but later, because they are educated in one discipline, then they spend a lot of time, and so maybe it needs to be it's for mature scholar, not only for very young scholar, and maybe we have to think of a long-term training. I don't know if you understand what I mean, to have this understanding of both parts, and especially to have a view of considering the tools, that these tools are not objective, even if it is. Because, yeah, some people think that, oh, it's systematic, it means that it's objective, but it's always an interpretation. It's very difficult to make people understand this kind of thing. something. But thank you for the question. I think this is exactly the question you have. But yes, Mark, because I really like your talk. No, because you insist on the role of model, and I think this is really the important problem from an epistemological point of view.
That's kind of the comment I wanted to make, which is that I agree very much with the question about tools as the object of digital humanities research, but I want to push back really, really strongly on the notion of the impoverishment of language, because that makes a really, really critical assumption, which is that we are replacing all of our critical models with the quantitative models. And that happens, but not, I think, within a well-structured digital humanities program, right? I mean, that's also one of the reasons why turning everything over to computational linguistics makes me also nervous, or data science, especially data science. These are important models to work with, but the notion of digital humanities sitting, and I think this is what Obvil does very, very well from my experiences with it, the goal of digital humanities should be to think methodologically about the computational aspects, not necessarily even tool-based, but think of them as methods that can be adapted to work in tandem with our critical models of language, and especially our critical models of literature, so that rather than replacing them, instead it can augment the ways in which we do this, so that we can do a project that says, we know this about 19th century literature or 19th century French literature of Paris, but we now can add this other model to it that not just says, well, we didn't know this as well, but gives us new ways to access other things we might want to know. Do you know what I mean? I'm struggling to articulate this, but it's both a discovery tool as well as a kind of empirical analysis, and I think used well. But this is the problem of creating a digital humanities program that balances the need to educate students in the humanities and the methods of the humanities, and convincing our colleagues in computer science and data science, et cetera, that they are equally valid ways of approaching it as well as the computational methods. And that's the hard solution.
I think... yes, this is the ideal, but the reality is that if you build a program, at least in Europe, you have to follow the prescriptions of the Bologna, and you have so and so many hours you're allowed to integrate in your program in order to call it an MA or a BA. And that means that compared to a regular humanities degree or a regular computer science degree, a digital humanities degree has to have less humanities or less computer science, because there's no other way around it. The only other solution is to do two parallel degrees or to have people with lots of money and lots of time to do two subsequent degrees, or like myself, instead of writing articles, writing code. But I certainly see the danger of impoverishment of the critical level of interpretation that we have reached by using computational tools. And I see the possibility of augmenting our knowledge by computational tools. The marriage of both, I think, is in a sense only possible if people can do both in a full time. And for that, we need to invent new scholarships that can cover that kind of type. Not 2-year master degrees, but 4-year master degrees. Not 3-year BAs, but 5 or 6-year BAs. Otherwise, we will lose on either side.
May I just say, so we are opening, it's the first year of our MA program in TOOL, and so, which we built with the computer science department, and saying that, well, hoping, in the hope that computer scientists having a license in computer sciences would come and then be get rid of computer courses and just take culture and learn music, art, history, and literature, of course. So we'll see. because it's also in the learning, it's in these places that connection will be made or not. It's with students working together at this level, starting at this level, that's what we hope, I mean. So having teams making small projects with one student coming from computer sciences and the other one coming from humanists. And so trying to learn to code. One is learning to code and the other one is learning is reading Rabelais. And
is there a requisite? So for example, if I'm a computer scientist, if I have a licence informatique, do I have to take the culture courses? Because if you give them a choice, they might just continue to take computer
science. No, we don't give them the choice. No choice.
I applaud.
No. If you come from computer science, you won't learn again what you already learned. We'll see.
I'd just like to push back on this impoverishment issue, partially because I think, just looking at it objectively, being able to access these enormous corpora and explore them in different ways is in itself an enriching exercise, both from the student's point of view and certainly from the point of view of someone who's been in the field for a long time. So I'd like you to explain exactly what you mean by impoverishment.
I subscribe to what you've just said and what Mark has said now. I think the issue is really to see, well, of course, we can ask new questions now, and we can ask new questions to the culture at large, you know, like you're doing with Encyclopédie, and also, as we saw this morning, with those models that Mark was showing us. But my issue has to do with what Mark was also pointing, the fact that this instrumentalization of textuality of language may become the new model of knowledge rather than something that is supplementary or something that can be combined with the traditional humanistic questioning and the level of interpretation that has to, I think there's a level of interpretation that has to be individual, so it has to be the self immersed in the language, and all the processes of distant reading are really processes of bringing the machine in between the self and the literary experience or language. And I think that's going to, I wonder if we are not inventing a new form of knowledge that will become the dominant form of knowledge in the future. No? And that's what I mean by impoverishment. No? So perhaps there's a certain level of the humanistic relation with language and with texts that we would not want to eliminate. No? And I wonder if we are not going there. So I wonder if the whole process of the development of digital humanities is not complicit with the general automatization of society. No?
Also, just one example. So the obvious example is tokenization. So a token is not a word. As far as I'm aware, please correct me if I'm wrong, but if we use the model of the dictionary, you will find many instances where you will have the same textual item, the same token, which will be listed separately under a completely separate header as a different word. And so if you're examining corpora on the basis of tokens, you are not examining corpora of words, right? Isn't that true? I mean, that leaves out metaphor, ambiguity, bread. You know, like if I'm using bread metaphorically, but treating it as a token. So it's not. That's an example. Obviously, you learn things from examining tokens because they broadly, statistically, probably correspond to words. And then the other big one is a post-structural linguistics. As far as I'm aware, there is not yet a well-established post-structural linguistics. We're still living in the world where the science of language is supposed to be about language as a whole, but uses textual evidence, as pointed out by Derrida. Despite what everyone says, there's a transcription that is made of speech, which does not actually correspond to linguistic behavior. And that's a huge problem. And it's basically the same problem, that we study transcriptions rather than study, we study data in the bad sense, or capta, what we happen to be able to see, rather than looking at the world and seeing what it might give us.
I like self-flagellation, it's fun. But I actually think that there are ways of moving. One of the things that I think we have introduced that's very interesting is the question of optics. Looking at different levels of text, from far away down into close. And one of the things that we do, at least, and we're committed to doing, is always bringing you back to the text and making you read the text. So in some sense, these are directed readings. You're being pointed at text that you might not have been pointed at otherwise. But you have to read the text. That's a position we have, and I think it is an important one that keeps the bread on the table, metaphorically and nutritionally. So.
I think along those lines, it's something that we've been thinking about within this realm. It's not just to make a nice visualization of data, but there's also training involved in how to interpret that data, how to interpret the graphs, and what they mean, and how to interpret a model, and what makes a, And I think that's an important skill it's under theorized and it's under taught. I think, and so I think if we can give people the idea that you're engaging with very complex modeling algorithms, and that they can produce almost anything, but the notion is then explaining exactly how you got to that process, and then interpreting those results in a meaningful way. And I think that's in and of itself a fairly good skill. That's we should try that.
I feel like one of the things that this discussion has sort of danced around is the notion that we're at a kind of inflection point at the moment in disciplinary change. When we think about the way other disciplines had constituted themselves in the past, something like computational linguistics became a field because the practitioners didn't need to know everything about linguistics and didn't need to know everything about computation, certainly, but instead there's some overlap, there's some intersection between the two that became a field that sort of gelled into a field in and of itself. And I feel like the same can be true of the digital humanities, that if one could imagine I can imagine two different worlds. One could imagine the ideal digital humanities student wouldn't need to know everything about computation. They may not need to know application development, systems architecture, et cetera, and wouldn't necessarily need to know everything humanities, or even in the particular field of humanities that they've found themselves in. They may not have a detailed training of 17th century literature and C-sharp application development, but would learn the ideal intersection of those two fields with some statistics, with some data science, with some other things that constitutes a field in and of itself that's appropriate to the kind of work that they want to do. And I think that's one possible model. The other one is that you know, we live in the dystopian nightmare that literature becomes a branch of data science, and we all move across campus, which is not the one I'm hoping for. But I think the challenge facing us is to figure out what this field looks like. What are the critical skills that a student or a practitioner needs to have in the mixture, and then creating programs that do the training necessary for those skills.
Actually, I think something important was said yesterday in the second panel, which was also about, actually hacking the tools that you know we shouldn't even trust the tools. And I think this kind of, you know, being critical towards the tools and even hacking them, also to figure out what it is they're doing. Because we in a way we live in this dystopian world, right? You know that we have Google, Amazon, whatever. You know, it all exists, so we also need to be very critical towards these kind of data mappings that, you know, runs our world. I would really like to see a digital humanities that also hack the tools and was able to criticize the way that data science work with Google. And I think we could do that with computer science, because, you know, they're not just evil masters of machinery. You know, they're also in the university because they're, you know, trying to develop alternatives or trying to be critical towards, you know, whatever the Googles of the world are doing. And maybe Google is not even evil, I don't know. Oh, well, they are. Okay.
I realize listening to you that my computer science student thinks that if something is not on the web, it doesn't exist. So, so maybe if you have no other question, I think we can pursue this discussion during the lunch, which is just in this room, and then we shall resume our conference at 2 p.m. Okay.